Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts and the way we live our lives please you, make you glad, give you confidence, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. As I watched the inauguration ceremony on Friday, I heard, and maybe you did too, Samuel Rodriguez, president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, pray in the words of the Beatitudes, Jesus' signature sermon. This is the sermon that says, "Blessed are the peacemakers and the meek and those who struggle for justice." Jesus' sermon that is all about compassion and dismantling barriers and living humbly. I thought it was a good prayer for that moment. A reassuring reminder that we share values that will move this country toward reconciliation and humility, a common humanity. I thought, good for him. Good for President Trump. I Googled Reverend Rodriguez later Friday morning, and the first thing that came up was a video of him entertaining a Christian audience by belittling the leaders of other faiths who had been invited alongside of him to lead prayers at another public event. Scoffing at how ridiculous it was to think that prayers of Islam and Judaism might have any power at all next to Christian prayers. I was so disappointed that a man who shares my faith tradition and who turns to the same words I do in a critical moment could hear the message of those words so differently from the way I do. These are strange days in our country. Days in which it is hard to separate our political opinions from our faith. To remember that no political party's agenda captures God's vision. And equally hard to put our spiritual lives and our politics together. To remember that before we are Democrats or Republicans, conservatives or liberals, we are followers of Jesus. It is hard to be both politically engaged and as loving and forgiving and open-hearted as our faith reminds us to be. Or maybe you think that politics and religion should never be put together, or even enter the same thinking or speaking space. So let's talk. Jesus preached his first sermon in his hometown, Nazareth. "I have come," he said, "to side with the poor, to set the prisoners free." Good, strong words he spoke. And we hear in those words God's intention for the good of all humanity. But those words were also a political speech, and Jesus' listeners in Nazareth heard them that way. But Jesus stood in a long tradition of prophets who criticized the government for not standing for God's values. The prophet Isaiah was speaking for God in the passage that Sherry read this morning when he said, "Here's the kind of spiritual practice that I want from you. To break the chains of injustice, to get rid of exploitation in the workplace, to free the oppressed, cancel debts." There is no action that could feel much more political than that. And it's from the parts of the Bible like this that there has come a long history of the church working for justice. The end of slavery, the civil rights movement, the end of apartheid in South Africa. The Bible is where our United Methodist social principles take their authority from when they say the church should continually exert a strong ethical influence upon the state. The church should support policies and programs that are just and oppose policies and programs that are unjust. Welcoming immigrants, changing the systems that exploit and oppress people, making sure every person is treated with dignity and equity, making peace. These are holy purposes, every bit as much God's concern as they are a political agenda. In fact, more a moral agenda than a political one. We think of those issues as political because we have tried to accomplish those goals by political action, through government. But our method of putting those values into place, making them the work of elected officials, that doesn't take them out of the concern of God or out of our responsibility as God's people. The beginning of every new administration in Washington is a good time to remind ourselves that our responsibility for this work continues long after we have finished voting. Maybe it's particularly important now when many people are skeptical about the values of a president who has drawn very clear lines around who will be included in the benefits of being an American and who will not. But at every moment, this is the truth. We cannot assign out the work of loving our neighbor. No government, certainly no president of the United States, can hold for us the conviction of our faith that the love and generosity that we have known has to be shared. So let me say this as clearly as I can. No matter who is president, the work of compassion remains the same. It's about making our communities safe for everyone, resolving conflict without violence, practicing forgiveness, welcoming the stranger, sharing our resources, caring for one another, no matter who we are, where we come from, what gender we are, or what our ability is. No matter who is president, no matter what the government does, this is our work, the church's work, Campbell United Methodist Church's work. If you are discouraged about what you can expect from Washington in the next 4 years, then don't expect the federal government to do the work that has been ours all along. The great no that was spoken yesterday in demonstrations around the world must now be translated into a powerful yes. No government has threatened the power given to us by God to be a people of compassion, a community where everyone is welcomed and cared for. That work is local and it is personal, not national, and it doesn't get legislated. It happens right here. The only thing that will keep us from making this place look like a little corner of God's kingdom is our own inertia, our failure to answer the call to do what God needs from us in this time. When I was in Cuba last year, the most remarkable thing I saw was a church that had learned resourcefulness under a government that had tried to limit its mission. When the Castro government was installed in 1959, churches were all but closed. Their social programs, schools, food distribution sites, childcare centers were all shut down. All the property that they owned for anything other than worship was confiscated. Sanctuaries were permitted to be used for worship only. They were prohibited from building any new churches and from congregating in public places. And the churches hunkered down for a while. They shrank in numbers. People were afraid. They didn't know what to do. In 1985, no one had been ordained in the Cuban Methodist Church for more than 10 years. But the spark in those churches did not die, and they began to come alive again. Under a regime far more oppressive and controlling than we will ever know in this country, they figured out what to do. They started new churches, not in new church buildings, but in living rooms. Small groups of people who gather together to sing and pray, to tell the stories that give them hope, to support one another. They've been creative. Every morning, church sanctuaries host prayer and fasting services so that every poor person who can't afford to eat breakfast is welcome to come and pray and then break the fast with a meal at lunchtime. On New Year's Eve, the churches were packed. I asked, why would young people choose to spend New Year's Eve in church? And the answer was, this is their statement. Being part of a church, worshiping God, is the most subversive, countercultural thing people can do. Do you really think that the love of God, the good intentions of God for this creation that he has poured himself into, can be defeated by any government? We, not the government, we are the ones who carry God's intentions. And there is always a way for love to rise up and break through. After the Brexit vote this last summer, a small movement began. People began to wear safety pins on the outsides of their shirts. And the idea was that wearing a pin would show that you were a safe person at a time and a place when hatred and suspicion of outsiders was also common. And that movement came and went pretty quickly, as those kinds of things do. But I read a story the other day of a 9-year-old boy named Charles who put one of those safety pins on his shirt. He wanted other kids on the playground to know that if they were being teased or bullied, he was a safe kid to run to. And he told his mom that that pin reminded him every day that if he saw anyone being teased or bullied, he should step in and stand next to them. And after Charles had worn the pin for a few weeks, he began to worry that the other kids would get so used to seeing that safety pin on him that they wouldn't even see it anymore. Maybe he'd even forget it was there. So he began attaching 2 safety pins to his shirt. Every morning, He even began putting them on his pajamas at night. And the pinholes began to stretch and warp the fabric of his clothes. But no matter. What mattered to that little boy was the steadfastness of his commitment to be a person who would step up for other people, move toward hateful situations, be a light in dark places. Now that work will look slightly different for each of us. So here's another picture. Prabhjot Singh is a Sikh man, a physician who lives in New York City. In 2013, he was attacked by a gang in his neighborhood where he lived. They called him a terrorist. They broke his jaw. And this was the third time that he had been physically assaulted since 9/11. After this attack, Dr. Singh became very angry. It was outrageous that this could happen to him, not just once, but over and over again in this country. The attack had broken not just his body, but his spirit. And so he turned inward. He turned to address what was happening inside of him. And he searched both his Sikh scriptures and the Bible. He meditated on the same message that he found in both places. And gradually, his outrage turned into gratitude. Gratitude that his wife and son weren't with him when he was attacked. That bystanders had intervened. That there seemed to be a way for him not to be imprisoned by hate. So gratitude became Dr. Singh's personal message. He began to say it out loud and then to speak it everywhere. And everywhere he went, he found support and encouragement. He got prayer cards from a church in Mississippi and letters from a Hindu temple in Los Angeles. But the most powerful response came from his neighbors. Grandmothers in his neighborhood who stepped into the street to hug him. Shopkeepers who shared their sympathy. Patients in the hospital asked him how he was feeling. His family began to feel safer in their neighborhood than they ever had before. His own compassion became an invitation to others to act compassionately. He changed things, not by attacking back against hatred, not by instructing other people how to think, but by connection. Our lives, our personal experiences, our professional skills, the nurturing of our spirits, all of those have been making us ready, polishing us for just such a moment as this. For the work that is in front of us, the work of being the people of God. For the project of building in this community a house of compassion and justice. Nothing is stopping us. This is the moment for us to get serious, to commit ourselves not just to a day of protest, but to the long, slow, practical, persistent work that is ahead. That work doesn't require a president or a governor or a legislature to lead it. But it demands our commitment to stay with it until it is done. Today is the day God calls us to be renewed in the image of our Creator, in care for creation, in hating violence, in seeing people and taking in people who are starving or seeking a home, in demanding that rich and poor alike have what they need. Today is the day that God brings good news to the poor and announces to everyone who has never yet gotten a break, that God stands with them. And the people said, "And so shall we." Amen.